are calling Dr. Joe Whitcomb.
Hey there, Eric. Can you hear me okay?
It's Dr. Joe Whitcomb.
Yes.
How you doing? This is Welcome to Highway Diary. This is episode 313 with Dr. Joe Whitcomb. I met this guy speed dating in Santa Monica. The girls weren't showing up. Right. You know, we went to a speed dating event, right? Was this like 2012 or 2013, something like that?
Yeah, it was around that time. That was the beginning of an end of the beginning for me. So I think that was right exactly then, yeah.
So What do you mean by that? A change of relationship? You were getting out there?
Oh, gosh. Oh, yeah, that was like, I just had been in a 20-year marriage, I was a leaver and left a lot behind, you know, so that, you know, you kind of lose a lot of your structure, people that you know that for the last 25 years. So, yeah, it was kind of like the beginning, a new beginning, kind of like that hero's journey, stepping out of what I know into this unknown, kind of this unknown world that... And that was the first thing I did, was try to get out there and do some speed dating. And it was...
Well, we get there, and the host doesn't show up. The girls don't show up. No, I'm looking at you, you're looking at me like two little lost puppies looking for love, looking for a new mommy, you know, to take them around and boss them around, you know. We're just like...
Oh, right.
And so then I'm like, hey, you're a cool guy. Where's the host? Where's the
That's
girls?
Right. I mean,
you know?
Right. And I'm new at this because, you know, I hadn't really dated since like the 80s, right? So I have no clue what I'm getting into. None whatsoever, right? It was like 1986, 87 was my dating scene, right? And married for so long. So I'm stepping into this with these 1980 dating rituals, right? Like from you know, the old classic 80 John Hughes movies where it was romantic to stand outside of someone's window with your boombox over your head, and now that's stalking. I didn't know that.
Frowned upon. You know? I know, culture's changed.
I didn't do that when, you know, back in the 80s, that was like you could sleep up in front of your, you know, this person's house that you like. Now, I don't do that. That wasn't me. But you know, because you kind of learn stuff along the way, you know, watching news and stuff, but what to do, what not to do. But, you know, old habits.
Yeah, society behavior. But we became friends immediately. I can't remember if we did or did not smoke weed, a couple joints in my Honda Civic that day, but I don't remember if that happened or not. But
it did? Well, it did for me. I don't know.
Oh, okay,
about
yeah,
you.
That happened. Yeah. That was fun. So I was just like, oh, now I got a buddy. There was no girls out here tonight. So we've kept in touch lightly for, I don't know, 7 years now. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's amazing, kind of like into the wild, like who you meet along your hero's journey, your recovery, you know, and just, you know, and the people that, you know, that kind of show up once in a while.
So you're a doctor of psychiatry, you're a therapist, and...
Actually, all but dissertation. I just want to be clear. I've finished all my degrees. I'm all but my dissertation right now that I'm working on for the last 7 years. So that's been an epic journey in itself. So I'm still in my dissertation, trying to figure out, I figured out what I was going to do, but that's a whole different conversation.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you keeping clients in a private practice while you're going through a divorce of a 20-year marriage? And then did that ever affect your job performance? Because I would imagine it would for me.
You know, it did not, you know, because, you know, I was military for about 10 years. So I kind of learned to, you know, I was in a, kind of a medical, you know, rescuing kind of field. You know, you kind of learn in the military to, you know, kind of have a very high threshold for pain and suffering and kind of stay in denial of the reality of all the shit that's coming at you at once, right? So you compartmentalize. So So I was able to do my task well. It actually made me a good therapist, empathetic, more compassionate, but it destroyed my personal life, right? Because it was bringing up a lot of the dysfunction and brain damage I had from just life and military and other crap that would go on, and some other stuff that, you know, kind of put me in a hard place to kind of navigate, going to school, working, all that, you know, and all these old addictive, you know, type of things started to show up for me, you know, that I was really unaware of. I didn't know how to have a problem until 1992, you know, and I didn't even know I had a problem then, really, until I started dealing with it. So,
what was your advice? What are you talking about? Are you talking about?
Since we're talking about addiction, right?
Today, yeah.
And, you know, kind of what's going on today in the world. And that's kind of what got me into recovery, was this problem I had. And I spent a lot of time denying it, postponing it, kind of refusing it, blaming everybody else for it. But it was a problem around trauma and some addiction around like a love addiction more type stuff, and codependency work that had big brain damage. Just a cluster, you know. I had some military executive functioning stuff going on back then, and I had no idea what was going on. I was so confused. And so I had to really create on start. So I started doing my work, right, like 25 years ago, on creating trauma-informed relationship type of programs, right, to work with couples. And, you know, I was just as lost as everybody, you know, just confused. Because it was like all these, multiple dimensions co-occurring simultaneously. Not one thing was going to define what the problem was out there or within me. So I started getting into this work, right, to kind of start working with it. Not so much addiction, but more so around trauma-informed and attachment work around relationship stuff, right? And the abandonment trauma, and just all the stuff you start seeing out there with trauma, and how that relates to addiction. And that's kind of what we're kind of base jumping into, I suppose, today.
It seems like, you know, humans have this need for, like, romantic love. You know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
When that, so that can be the golden gate. That can be the pillar of light in the psyche of the individual to sort of heal them through a relationship. Heal that. Well, at least I have my wife and I have my picket fence, and like this is what I'm doing. I don't have to like constantly be searching for a woman all the time in the back of my head, driving me crazy, bringing up my insecurities. So then when that attachment isn't there, then the it's so much easier to abuse substances to get through those golden gates. We all want to feel good. We don't always want to earn it the right way, especially when we realize that some of the games we have to deal with are our own demons. Is that what you're saying, Dr. Joe Wickholm? All but dissertation?
Yeah. Facing those dragons, you know, and I know for me, you know, kind of going in there, noticing whatever those attachment, injuries are, and the trauma, you know, that comes up from that, you know, from all the stuff that comes up in relationship, right? So, yeah, I mean, you're dealing with, like, for me, you know, when I work with addiction, I'm really looking at it from an attachment perspective, like our attachment needs, right, or what they get this about. So like an attachment injury or someone has abandonment trauma, you know, so drugs or alcohol or anything can be like a great servant to kill the master, but it becomes like a moth, when it becomes kind of like a moth to a flame, or it becomes like takes total control over your actions, like takes control precedence of your life, and, you know, then you start having a problem, right? Because then because the drugs become a competing attachment to kind of a false solution to our real need, which is connection, right? Bottom line, you know, to kind of
connection, community.
Connection. Yes. Yeah. That's the problem. Connection. And what's the, you know, what's in the inability to create connections or make connections happen, right?
Dr. Joe Whitcomb, do you think that sometimes people protesting in a mob against their government or against protesting against whatever, the mob, is that unrequited love, that need for connection? Is that why?
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Well, the protest is really, if you go back to attachment theory and Bowlby, around the secure attachments and then the insecure attachments, the anxious one that's kind of more like a wave that's really more preoccupied with the anxious, you know, the attachment style. And then you have the insecure, more avoidant, right? Kind of an island. And you have more of the come close, more chaotic attachment style. So yeah, when you have someone, let's say attachment protest, we're just gonna use an attachment term. You know, when, let's say, someone is stonewalling you, right, or isolating, or you're texting them, they don't respond, you know, or they're ghosting you, right, that's going to trigger, you know, a lot of those old antiquated abandonment trauma triggers, right? And so you start blowing up the other person's phone, right? And then you feel a lot of shame around that, because it's like, hey, I'm trying to get a connection here. So the fight, yeah, you're right. Attachment need around this fight for connection. And when that's not being able to be had, we kind of, you know, we create a lot of strategies to cope with that when we don't get it. And sometimes that goes to the addiction.
Is there a meritocracy to the psychology shrink racket? You know what I mean? So I do comedy and I look around. And some of the greatest comedians, I'm like, oh my God, that joke is as funny as any HBO special I ever saw. Like, sometimes you'll just see it in like one joke where like a comic will be undeniably just like amazing, you know? And then when they don't have success, mainstream success, it's like, wow, you know, I feel like I'm lied to. Why? Well, Comedy Central's not talking about this guy. So the whole, you know what I mean? There's something wrong with the system. Do you ever feel in that... In your field, do you ever wonder about who gets more success, or do you not get jealous like that?
No, I don't. I mean, I just think that whole thing is, you know, it's kind of it kind of goes into what's healthy and unhealthy, right? It's kind of like in our codependency, like this, we get into these one up, one down type of dynamics, one up, one down relationships. You know, top dog, bottom dog, lover, beloved, sinner, saint. You know, rescuer, victim, perpetrator, victim, and you get into these polarized type of viewpoints, right? And stances, you know, so you get into these stances around this when you start getting into these comparisons, right? So comparison, you know, is like the root of evil, root of suffering, and the thief of joy. So I'm not really invested, and I don't have a lot of room in my heart into a lot of time or energy or thought into those types.
Wait a minute. Are you saying I'm a needy, jealous douchebag? Because that's what I was yelling at myself in the car today.
What?
Yeah.
You're not a selfish.
Listen,
douchebag.
You don't know.
You're on your own yoga mat, you know, brother. So, you know, it's when you start judging other people's practice that you start, you know, feel all that suffering. You know, I go to yoga sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes. I used to go a lot, especially back then. I was in this really bad funk and I started doing yoga. And when we get into that meritocity, you know, it's like I go to yoga and I'm on my yoga mat and, you know, they call me the crocodile wrestler. You know why?
Why?
I look like I'm wrestling invisible crocodiles from out there. So it's kind of like a term of endearment. But, you know, if I'm comparing myself to that young 20-year-old who's been doing gymnastics and yoga since she was like 5 or 2, I'm never going to go, dude. You know, so I just stay out of that whole game of just staying on my own yoga mat, my own practice, you know, not really try to worry about what other people are trying to do, because that's not going to, I have no power to change those people's lives other than what we can do, right? in the year. So that's where I put my time and energy, you know, not so much on politics. Yeah, I'm like Switzerland. I'm always on the side of relationship. I try to stay clear of all that.
I don't know why. I think I flagellate myself. Like, I'm just like, it'll be, and exactly what you were saying was right. Like, I have all these podcasts booked, and I'm going on other people's podcasts. People are coming on mine. And there's this one podcast that it's like, I'm like, why aren't I getting booked for this one podcast? And I was literally screaming at myself on the way, on the way to playing disc golf. You know, I'm not good at yoga, but I play a lot of frisbee golf. And when I'm not there, I'm in the boxing gym. So that's how I get my exercise. That's where I clear my head. But like on the way there, I have all these dark, jealous feelings. Why aren't I doing this? Well, I should be here. That guy's not even funny.
Yeah, I mean, like going back to our addiction, right, our attachment, right, all this, the orbits that we have, all these, you know, that we attach our lifestyle and values, personality, all these things that kind of define us, you know, as humans, you know. And, you know, I ran, you know, when I got into this whole trauma-informed relationship psychotherapy work and now doing trauma-informed virtual reality research development, I didn't think I was going to be doing all this work around, you know, working with attachment, like a grandiosity, working with attachment stuff, a grandiosity and shame and all this stuff. But, you know, it's been the one thing that saved me, you know, from my own, you know, being able to stay on this yoga mat.
Yeah. Attachment. Can you, now that you say that, can you define that from a different angle so that I get a better idea what you're talking about? How did you come to the attachment stuff? It just kept happening.
Well, that came up while I was doing my work at Pepperdine in the Chicago School, and then in my internship, I got involved with an attachment-based. And so attachment is just kind of like a theory of love. It's like a science of love. It's based on neuroscience, the psychology of the hardwiring of the brain and the nervous system, and then just how our body is wired for connection. You know, our brain is so socially wired to love, to connect, to belong, right? And those were things that I struggled with. Right, I struggled with having attachments, right, relationships, and my own trauma. So it was really intriguing to me. So I started getting into, like, really looking at, there's like four attachment styles that attachment theory gets into, Bowlby, and I started getting into emotionally focused work around shame, work around addiction, attachment theory, and it was really important, you know, to kind of understand how childhood these aversive childhood experiences, you know, and injuries, you know, cause a lot of the emotional, physical, you know, wounding and create some of these belief systems and shame stuff that we get triggered by every day, right? That triggers us into this vicious cycle, right? Where something happened in the past and we have that story about what happened and interpret, and we add so much meaning, we get in that vicious cycle of the addiction, right? And so I wanted to find out for myself, mostly, but then being in the military and having been homeless before, working with trauma, it was just one of those things that captured my thing. So love addiction was kind of, you know, because you have different types of addiction. You have substance or process-like addiction. So we know the substance addictions, like drugs, alcohol, coffee, whatever. But a lot of the process like addictions, like love addiction, gambling, sex addictions, those types of things, you know, are hard to do because they're really rooted deeply into our attachment systems. So whether we feel securely attached or insecure attachments, you know, each of those attachments kind of shape or form, you know, a certain coping strategy around how we function, right?
Yeah. What?
So let's say, for instance, yeah. Go ahead. You're going to ask the question.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, where did the the politicians of California study? What satanic temple did they study at where 5 years, the other person gets half? Now, knowing about love addiction, attachment disorders, you know, a doe-eyed puppy dog looking for love out there. That's how I met Joe Whitcomb. I'll tell you that for sure.
Yeah, right.
How does that,
know? Well, no, I'm not at it right now, but I'm will be in about a year.
If you're, you know, an alcoholic, what does that cost you? You know, a 12-pack, you know, if you're a crack addict, what? How much is crack? There's deals out there.
Oh, my gosh.
Marriage. You know, oof, that is a...
But love addiction, I'll tell you, right?
Half.
That's expensive addiction right there.
Yeah. So where did they study? Are these the Project Paperclip Nazi scientists that came over, you know, after World War II, and then they started California and did the marriage laws? Is that their first order of business? To disenfranchise, to disenfranchise hope in a population and to gain of function as much suffering as possible?
You know, go back to my previous thing on conspiracy theories. I have no idea. I don't know.
Here, okay. This is not a conspiracy. This is in the public domain, Dr. Joe Whitcomb.
Well, I have no idea. Tell me about that, because I'm really curious.
Let me just put it like this.
I don't know anything about that.
Okay. Yeah. I have been saved by psychiatry. You know, when I was at the University of New Orleans dealing with my attachment disorders, you know, I had two cheating breakups in a row, and I was going crazy. Then my friend died, and this doctor, Dr. Reed Doster in New Orleans, saved my life. He's a great psychiatrist. But psychiatry can be used for evil. It can be used for propaganda. It can be used to, like, as a soldier, you know this, to gain a function around how sweet of a man Dr. Joe Whitcomb is, they have to feed you propaganda about your enemy so that you dive over the bunker and you start shooting. That's also psychiatry. That's also, that's the dark side. And Lee Riefenstahl was a, Lee Riefenstahl is a famous filmmaker, a propagandist filmmaker for the Nazi Party. And but even today people go, well, she was kind of a good filmmaker, you know, she was kind of, you know, even today people are like, well, she's pretty good at making movies though, you know what I mean? But so even cinema can be a dark art of propaganda.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I guess what I'm saying is there's a dark side to psychiatry.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a absolutely.
It could be manipulative. It can be used to manipulate
humanity, unfortunately. And psychiatry and psychology has their dark side too. Whether it's whether it's inside or outside, you know, we're all dealing with our, you know, all these psychoses that people get into, you know, and it's really tragic to see it kind of get, you know, re-traumatizing in these areas that are supposed to be there. You know, I always say there's help, and there's helpful help, and then there's help that's not helpful at all. It's actually dangerous. And that's the dangerous side of certain aspects of this, where it stops being helpful help, where it actually starts causing harm and suffering.
Like cults, like Scientology, you know?
Yeah, you know, and you get stuck on an ideology, or, you know, that's where I'm so... you know, a bit of a renegade, I suppose. You know, I'm against protesting, picketing. I just don't know how to show it, you know, but that's frustrating to people.
So you should picket the picketers.
Yeah, I know.
So,
you know, I could, but I'm against it. So how do I do that?
Speaking of visual things that re-traumatize you, we're Facebook friends. And one day, Dr. Joe Whitcomb, he throws up a great Facebook ad, you know, posting, you know, we're friends. And you're wearing a tie-dye shirt, you're going, and I think the message is, just got back from Kiev, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this guy's traveling to Ukraine. You know, maybe he picked up a wife over there, this little puppy dog guy looking for love. I don't want to re-traumatize you or anything like that.
Right.
But, did you find any ladies in the Ukraine or anything like that?
You know, it was really interesting, you know. I went over there to find it, you know, to see about a girl, right? So I did, just to be honest. Didn't see her a lot. She's from the Donetsk area, that part of Ukraine that's had a lot of Russian occupation, a lot of trauma. She's got a small village, you know. So I'd been talking to her like 4 months, like online, you know, just kind of getting to know her. And it was really interesting moving it from the dating app into like Facebook and then video chatting. Because the girl doesn't speak any English, right? So, and I don't speak any Russian, just to be fair to her, to level playing field. So I started to try to learn Russian, right? So it was really cool, you know, and I started learning a lot about, through Google Translate, interpretation. And as a therapist, you know, and doing couple therapy, it's always interesting about interpretation and translating and adding and subtracting meaning. And so I'm like sending her these Google text translates from English. So I said to her, hey, baby, I got your back, right? So I had sent it to her a few times, but I never got a response. And I Googled and I reversed it, right, to English. And it said, hey, child, I got your spinal. So I'm like, no wonder why this thing is not moving forward.
I'm going to rip your spine out.
Yeah. And I called her a child. Yeah. You know, so, you know, it was like not working. Hmm. So, you know, because there's a lot of ritual differences there, cultural differences. But, you know, it's really romantic there. That's because one of the things I observed. So I'm thinking about, this is crazy. This is going to be crazy. I'm announcing it here. I've already started the process. I'm going to be doing traveling. I'm announcing it to you right now. I'm going to be traveling and spending 6 months in a different country doing teletherapy and coaching and groups for about 6 months in each country. I've got my whole team set up, my structure, my base camp, all my communications team, everything, getting that set up. So we're going to be doing some stuff. I wanted to do some research around different cultures around, you know, trauma, because there's a lot of trauma there coming out of the Ukraine and wartime. And we deal with a lot of that here in the United States. But we get a lot of help here. And I'm trying to do some research there around dating, relationships, trauma in that industry, or in that country, and do the virtual reality work. I may be spending my time there doing therapy, you know, back here, which were virtually. But it was so cool, brother. You know, watching, it's very traditional. It's almost really old school there, like old world. The men would push in the chairs, open the doors, bring flowers, gifts. If they were sweating, they like blow on the woman's hair. Very attentive, you know, in the dating. They dance like crazy over there. It's wonderful. So the culture was, you know, so I've got really intrigued around trauma in different parts of, like, here. But the opportunity for me to kind of explore that and how addiction and all these things kind of work in different countries and how it applies here, it's kind of like going to be my next level thing.
That sounds great. So you're going to the Ukraine and Russia for 6 months to.
Well, I'm going to do Kiev for 6 months, Odessa for six, and I'll probably do Italy for 6 months, and then 6 months in Sydney. I've got it mapped out for the next 5 years. So I'll be back and forth, though, but you won't miss me. I'll be here.
Okay.
But that's kind of, I'm talking about your, you know, because you're talking about addiction and attachment stuff. Right?
Yeah.
And love withdrawal and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's really, I think people, how do you think people have been impacted during COVID over all this stuff?
Like, I think that they're being intentionally traumatized by some international bankers for some kind of nefarious ends, but I don't want to get into politics too much on this one. I want to talk about psychiatry. But that's my best guess.
Nothing about that. Nothing.
My best guess is, I'm friends with certain people. So there's a guy called Klaus Schwab, and he runs the World Economic Forum. They have a week. Every year they meet in Davos, Switzerland, to discuss how they're going to take over the world. And so he's got a kid called Klaus Schwab Jr. So I know Klaus Schwab Jr. I know his sons, and he has a great Instagram. Oh, wow. So that's how I get my information. Sort of directly from that insider. But
I would love to hear more about that because I know nothing.
Well, if you go to
5 inches wide and a mile deep, off my yoga mat. So I'd love to hear more about it.
Well, you can go to erichollerbach.com and click on the and then / Klaus Schwab Jr. and everything that goes on his Instagram goes there. So, that's my friend.
I'm gonna check that out.
Yeah,
I'm actually gonna check that out today.
Okay, check. So erichollerbach.com/Klaus Schwab Jr. A lot of very disturbing information is coming from that guy. I repost on my website. Anyway, can I tell you a story about ladies?
Yes, tell me the story about ladies.
I went to the University of New Orleans. Okay, I got my master in screenwriting. I did, then I moved to California. Was in LA from 2017 to 2018, August to August. And I was trying to sell my screenplays and I was trying to get a freaking agent or manager in screenwriting. But I was still, Uber driving to make rent, to do everything. And so I sent out 400 letters to every talent agent in America. 400 handwritten letters. Then I called them all. I emailed them all. I called them all again. I emailed them all again. I got my master in screenwriting. I got a 4.0. I got 2 scholarships. I'm getting nothing for it. Nothing. Hello? Can you hear me?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Yep, I hear you now.
So I was getting, I couldn't get a talent agent from all this work. So then I pick up these ladies in my Uber car. And I almost ran the car off a bridge because what they said scared me to my core. They go, Charlotte, she did real well for herself. She married the one, so she gets $1,500 a month from the first husband. And then she married the second. Oh, he was a nice boy from Columbus, Ohio, but he didn't know the ways of the woman. So she gets 15 from the first one and $3,500 a month from the second
one. Oh, my gosh. Wow.
And then she's like, and I'm going to divorce my husband because he just went blind and I realized I wasn't in love anymore. Oh, and then this one. And then they all were scheming like Cruella de Vil, how to extract the most money possible from men while I was Uber driving them, a working man, by the way. The system was giving me nothing in return, and I was like, maybe I could just do a humanity a favor right now.
Oh my god!
It was like boiling my blood.
You're in the design room of the feminine, and nothing, I get it. I'm not. Oh man, that had to be being an insider. Of that conversation had to be terrifying.
It was terrifying. It was terrifying because they were sincere. They were going, this is how to do it.
So, right. So you kind of see how you kind of group think this stuff pretty well.
So it was shocking. I've never been privy to a conversation like that in those terms before. And it was really.
Oh, man. Brother, I wish, man, if you could sit behind some of these walls and hear what I hear sometimes, it's terrifying what people will do to one another,
As a therapist, you hear, unimaginable cruelty.
Oh, yeah, so much. It's really hard sometimes hearing, and then just trying to redirect them so they don't jump. Don't go there. Go away from the light.
Yeah.
Away, and it's And it's, you know, when people are hurt and have pain and, you know, suffering, man, they come at you with stadium lights and just like a sledgehammer. So man, it's hard to see. It's hard to hear. Humanity going this way, you know?
Yeah. You know, as a therapist too, and all therapists are trying to heal themselves while they heal other patients. Is it hard, especially with one with attachment disorders? Is it hard to, how does the trauma of others, like, impact the practitioner?
Well, I can't speak for everybody else's process. I know for me, I have to always kind of stand my proverbial yoga mat, you know, and I have other unique disorders or disabilities, so I've had to kind of create structures and stabilities and, you know, other scaffolding around me to kind of operate, kind of operations and money world type stuff. So it's kind of like, you know, well, for me, you know, it's, I always have to be in my own practice, you know, and that's almost like a daily thing. And when I'm not on my yoga mat, I get in trouble, kind of like a toppling over. Because it is a lot to kind of carry and sit with people's shame and terror and trauma and, you know, and not absorb some of that, right? And being an empath, I can kind of that empathy, you know, or kind of like emotional contagion, you know, you can absorb a lot of people's stuff. So it's hard, you know, managing all that, but, you know, it's part of the job, and, you know, you get good at it. But then, you know, if you're not in your practice, it can really, you know, because I had a professor one time say, Joe, you can only take people as far as you're taking yourself. And that was a challenge, right? So I've always been working on my person, myself, and, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have other people on your path that want to practice with you. So it makes it hard.
Women.
Women. Well, brother, I know.
So you said...
We men love to blame the women.
No, I just said it out loud to get to my next
women, thing. You know. But, you know, it's... You know, I discovered, brother... It's all of us, brother. We all got, I've got my brain damage, and what I've really discovered is that, you know, the wounding of the world, you know, we got to heal the world, you know, to heal the war between the sexes, and it is, you know, we got to heal the war within ourselves. And so that, you know, having done my own inner work and kind of going, wow, I can see why women sometimes retaliate.
I know. Dude, I'm crazy. I'm no tree. Trust me, I'm jealous. I scream at myself in the car what a loser I am all the time. I'm a mess. Oh, I'm a mess.
Wow.
Joe, you don't know who you're talking to. I'm spiteful. I'm the worst.
Well, that's part of our attachment stuff, you know. We kind of either rage in or we're raging out, right? You know, and, you know, it's those little small Lieutenant Dan moments that we have up in the crow's nest when we're raging against the dying of the lights and, you know, and nothing's working, you know, and it's like, what the heck is going on? You know, and all that frustration, you know, we get blocked, you know, as men, you know, we get blocked and we just feel this inner frustration, you know, and that kind of triggers us into kind of other things, you know. You know, kind of like trauma and addiction, you know, kind of imagine, you know, it's like you grew up, this story, we tell this story all the time when we're dealing with addiction and trauma and attachment stuff, and we're talking about the brain and the neuroscience. In polyvagal theory, we talk about neuroception. It's kind of like, it's detection without awareness. And that means our nervous system cannot really pick up and is aware it's like something happening, but our brain's not really cueing in on what's happening, just not aware, right? And so part of work, you know, addiction and attachment stuff. So imagine with trauma, right? You grew up in a, let's say you grew up in a forest, right? You're walking through the forest and you see a bear, you know, and in your brain, your nervous system goes in a fight, flight, freeze, right? And that's adaptive. That's what you should be doing when you're in the woods with a bear. But let's say you're at, you know, that fight, flight, freeze, and, you know, and the body keeps score. That's kind of one of those doctor psychology things, you know, how the body keeps score and that kind of fight, flight, you know, you get into these attachment type stuff. Let's say that you go home and you're living in a house and the bear lives with you, right? And you can't fight it. You can't run away from it. You can't flee. And, you know, you kind of get into these kind of coping strategies to cope with, you know, the powerlessness, the helplessness you might feel from not being able to, you know, manage that chronic stress. You know? And so when you're dealing with addiction, you're dealing with shame and attachment stuff, you know, this attachment injuries, abandonment trauma, you know, there's a cluster of things that can be going on in a person's life. And because you get all these, you know, a lot of times the trauma being like this cataclysmic boulder through the windshield, right? It's not like that. It can be like pebbles or rocks flying up in your windshield, leaving little dings in it. And then all these little cracks come on your windshield. And now you can't see through it. And all you can see is through the windshield, through the rear of your mirror, all the debris that you're leaving behind you. And then all the shame you feel with that, right? So when you're dealing with addiction, you're dealing with all this attachment stuff and prior wounding and some of these compulsions of acting out, despair, that kind of shame, guilt cycle we get into, you know, preoccupation, obsession, fantasy, you know, and so when we're, you know, and so when I'm dealing with love addiction and, you know, we go through or even, because I can't really speak to like substance or alcohol addiction because I'm not trained. That's beyond my scope of competency. But being someone that's in recovery, you know, I know that, you know, this is the dragon we're here to slay, you know. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And you asked me about the lockdown and group trauma, and I totally agree with you. I mean, you know, that what bugs me about the marketing behind COVID, which is, you know, influenza with a really good PR agent is COVID. And they decide to lock everything down. And, you know, so when they lock everything down, what did they tell kids? You'll kill grandma. You will kill her if you don't get this jab. You will kill her if you don't get this experimental RNA
chip. So using like fear, anxiety, threats, kind of coercion, kind of type persuasion.
Which is interesting because that's
children and people into taking this vaccination.
Which is interesting because that's exactly what the Nuremberg trial said not to do. So that's interesting. Right. And then who's trying to do it? This German called Klaus Schwab. Interesting. So it's, it sounds like the same idea
like
to me.
History repeating itself like another reenactment. Have you ever read the books it's called The Fourth Turning or Generations? It's a great book.
No.
It talks about how country, you know, it's kind of a prophetic type of thing about American history, and talks about the seculae and how we repeat, you know, just like in our own lives, you know, we kind of go around, you know, it's kind of like the Israelites walking around the desert for like 40 years trying to get in the promised land, you know, and, you know, we keep repeating, you know, these historical things and we forget. And it's good that we have people that are reminders, you know, that are throwing up the alert, like, hey, remember this stuff because this is dangerous, you know, territories to go down. But that book is really good, worth turning, because it talks about the seculae of how this, like, every 25, 100 years, these things start repeating. And, you know, but it's kind of from a social psychology and from a kind of a anthropology perspective and looking at it through that lens, I go, yeah, it makes sense. Mm. We're repeating history again. We're not getting the lesson or the experience or the lessons from them. So, good.
It sounds like a anthropological, traumatic reenactment.
Yeah, it's like sociology. It's kind of like predictive. You know, it's like, you know, we predict the stock market, you know, long term.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are like predicting, looking back like 2,000 years to now, and then kind of looking at predicting what the future would look like based on these, I guess you call them algorithms now, you know, and where, you know, how things keep repeating itself, you know, and these seasons. So it kind of takes out the fear in me to, in the struggle, to kind of go, okay, you know, this is coming up. What's next? You know, what's going to be the pendulum swing to this predicament, to this crisis, right? Because, you know, that's how life is. It kind of ebbs and flows. So I'm not freaking out too much about next level. It's going to be horrendous. It might be very painful because we're seeing fallout because of all the false evidence that they make appear real on, you know, both sides of them. But now I think it's really intriguing when you can zoom out to like 30,000 feet and kind of go, okay, look at it from other angles. And I guess that's more my kind of approach to things, you know, contrarian approach, you know, kind of looking at it from another angle. So that's kind of how I'm seeing things, you know, what's coming up next? You know, if this is true right now, what's going to be true in the reaction to that? And I'm pretty confident those things will unfold.
Yeah, it's, well, I don't know. I just see everything as you know, there's so many things that came and went. This is me, my conspiracy self is coming out now. But there's so many things that came and went, in my opinion. You know, like the JFK assassination, when I know it was Alan Dulles and Herbert Walker Bush and Lyndon Baines Johnson killed JFK. They were there. But are we ever told that? Are they tried and hung for it? And then, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin got us into Vietnam. Then that was proved to be a bullshit made up by McNamara pretending that he had a miscommunication with the boat. Then it's like 9/11 comes and goes. Looks like there were bombs inside the building. Looks like it was an inside job. That comes and goes. Then now you want me to take a false flag injectable? Like, fuck you. How about we hang all these other pieces of shit that pulled off all... Oh, it's still you guys because you're still in charge. It's always been the same group. So that's...
Absolutely.
So that's where I come from about this.
You got the right power and the opposing power, right? So what's the rising power trying to do now?
It's just... I can't... Until we have serious truth and reconciliation stuff about obvious crimes of the past, and I don't care I don't care what you leak... Oh, the CIA declassed this. Fuck you. Well, then where's the trial? Where's the heads? Cut their heads off. Where's that? And if you're not doing that part, just declass, like right after the day after Herbert Walker, you know, dies of whatever, then they declass all of his skeletons. How about while he's alive? We have those documents now, you know? And so when we're not doing this process of getting rid of draining our own swamp, I just think it, you know.
Whatever. Well, you're talking about accountability, right?
Yeah.
Accountable, right? You know, because we're talking about freedom and accountability, right? I think we want our freedom without responsibility or accountability, right? So, yeah, I think that's important, right? For society right now, we're seeing a lot of people abandoning, you know, just... we want our freedom without responsibility or accountability. Right. And other people want the accountability and hold people, you know, kind of subjugated to that with holding their freedom. And that's a balance that's really going to be, and I think we got to stand on the side of relationship and freedom and be responsible for those relationships that we're working through right now in society. And it's hard. I mean, you know, brother, it's like... what you're saying is true. You know, there's no accountability, and the trickle down is nobody's taken responsibility for anything and disavowing responsibility. And so we got this, you know, it's just, in my world, I'm stopping it in my world. So I don't know how to stop it in other people's world. right?
Well, look, me and you deal with our own attachment disorders every day. And we had the benefit of going to school. You know, we had the benefit of going to kindergarten, middle school, high school, face-to-face with everybody, looking each other in the eyes. And still, it's hard for me to talk to girls. Still, I get choked up. Imagine this generation doing virtual class, virtual everything, virtual school. They don't see each other. Where are these social mating ritual dance moves going to come from?
You know, that's interesting you say that, right? We lost our little brother. We lost our soul, our minds, you know, our touch. You know, we're in a state of chaos, you know, collectively, you know, and this is not the first time we've been here, you know, and just bewilderment, disillusionment, and that creates a lot of panic and anxiety and fear, you know, all this uncertainty that we're living in right now. And so I think, you know, for me, in the work I do, it's trying to work and bring clarity to all that uncertainty, you know, certainty, and trying to, like, walk people through and zoom it out from 30,000 feet and kind of look at, because this is really a good time for us, right? For us to kind of start working on what's going on inside, right? Because we're starting to lose control of everything outside of us, right? And then all that fear and frustration, fatigue and failure we feel by trying to control the stock market from going up and down, you know? And we have no control, right, of any of that stuff. But it seems to be something that we lose our minds over trying to do. And it's when we can do a lot of work inside, you know, in this period of time. It's a great opportunity.
You're saying to cleanse yourself, make yourself better, make yourself more spiritual aware. Now is a good time because, you know, then you're able, you're competent to face your adversary. Right.
Well, you know, when we get into, you're talking about these attachment stuff, and I'm talking about, you know, relationships and, you know, all these types of things with society. You know, nothing in the world has prepared us for any of this. You know, nothing prepares for 9/11, these wars, this coronavirus, you know, and we're just kind of making it up as we go along, right? And some of us are surviving and thriving okay. And, you know, and I always say, you know, it doesn't matter if you're drowning at 1 foot, 7 feet, or 21 feet, you're drowning. And what we want to start doing is like, okay, I was at 7 feet at one time, going to 21, I was a mess. And I had to really work on kind of fading everything out. Like, I wasn't going to get help from the government. I wasn't going to get help from friends. I wasn't going to get help from anybody. You know, and I had to, like, climb up this mountain, you know, because I'm not a victim, right? But I had to, like, figure out what were my resources and what do I need to do to, you know, leapfrog up this mountain. You know, and it's hard, you know, because when you're dealing with life, we're dealing with, like, these, our addictions, and we're dealing with the types of different strategies. You know, the addiction and all these attachment things take control precedence, and it's like you're drowning, right? And when you're drowning, you know, they say hurt people, you know, broken people break people. You're like drowning, and you're like people that are there to help you, or you're there to help them. You're like drowning together. And COVID was kind of like that, right? We're all kind of like drowning. And we don't even know it. Like, we don't have oxygen because nothing's prepared us for this isolation and alienation and all this uncertainty. And, you know, children haven't been able to be schooled and socialized and normalized. And, you know, all the, you know, money going to buy, you know, people like big companies that don't need it and small little companies that do need it are like getting leftover breadcrumbs. So, you know, the system's broken because look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you just kind of like, duh, it's not rocket surgery, you know, some of the stuff we can figure out, you know, but I don't know. But that my work is, the work I'm doing more so with addiction and attachment stuff is really to do like vent intervention type work and helping people get back to shore and learn how to swim and connect and belong and you know, because it's hard going it alone, you know, when you're in a Dante's ninth level of hell, you know, it's that hell loop that you get stuck in when you're caught up in that addiction. You'll do everything to kind of protect it, and until you realize what the cost is and the impact that's had on your relationship, it's not going to change.
Yeah, I see a lot of myself in you, Dr. Joe Whitcomb. Like, you know, I'm in this nice apartment in Austin, Texas, but one girl from Kiev, you know what I mean? And I'm on the streets. So,
oh, brother, I know.
One girl from Kiev away from homelessness.
One girl, but again, we can't blame the girl, right? I'm blaming myself, you know, and I've got to take 100%. And that's part of our, when we're dealing with my addiction and my shame, I got to deal with two parts of me, right? I got to deal with the part of me that's grandiose. The part of me that is kind of like relentless, unstoppable, kind of, you know, thinking I can do whatever. And that part of it is dealing with my shame, you know, the failure of all this. And then working on my boundary, you know, we're dealing with like attachment stuff and addiction, you know, it's not the girl, you know, it's like the boundaries are really there kind of like as a way of protecting myself from the world, protecting us, and then where we begin and end, where other people kind of begin and end. But also boundaries are there at the world from me, you know, and my problems, my addiction, the stuff that I'm causing, you know. And so the girl was just kind of a, you know, kind of a revelation, kind of a eye-opener to where a lot of my own codependent addictions were kind of leading me, right? And it was like a hard circuit breaker of my life, right? Going, Joe, you're investing in a very dark abyss here in your addiction, you know? And I'm talking about love addiction, you know, around my attachments and that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's interesting. It's really interesting, you know, how this stuff kind of plays out and how one person, you know, and you mentioned something about women, you know, and hear about what we're working on with the addiction and attachment stuff. And some of the work that's really super important is the work that we're doing with the wounding of the patriarchy or the wounding of the masculine, right? And the collusion with that, like the abuse and all that stuff that you see. And that's part of where you're not just healing the individual, we're working on healing the society, right? Bringing trauma to society and working with it and helping that work out. But this is important stuff we're talking about, right?
Absolutely.
The politics of this, the world, you know, it's how the world's kind of unraveling right now.
You know, and I think for me, you know, just looking back, what a privilege it was that when I was in kindergarten, I went from this real life class to now we're going to finger paint, and now we're going to physical education, now we're going to science, now we're going to, you know, we're going to read a little story, nap time, snack time, get on the bus, you're out. And it's like, what a privilege to have done that from kindergarten, preschool, all the way through grad school, you know, getting my master in screenwriting. Everything was in person. And I got my final degree in 2017. You know, what a fucking privilege it was for me, and what an advantage it is. And to see, like, if I was able to get away with, like, I don't know, 5 of those years, instead of, and you know, they put porn on everyone's internet. They don't block that. So what am I going to do when I'm 15 years old? Am I going to watch hardcore penetrative pornography, or am I going to go to math class? Like, what the hell is going on here?
That's not even an option or a choice.
What the hell is going on here? I was motivated. I was motivated because to go to class, to talk to girls and be the smart guy in class, so then the girls go, oh, He's the smart guy in class. So then I'm literally motivated to do the actual work, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's the difference between reality and fantasy, right? So when we're talking about attachment stuff and addictions and talking about what's real and what not, you know, you know, the porn's kind of a false solution, right, for a real need for connection. And then you kind of found a way to connect, right, through, you know, your intellect and your charm, and, you know, you developed some relationship skills. So you weren't, like, caged behind this pornography addiction. You were starting to get other resources that took you out of that pornography addiction. So, you know, that's the thing that a lot of people don't really get to learn how to do well if they don't have other requisite skills, right? So, you know, for me, I'm like 5 inches wide, no matter how deep. I'm good at like five things. Everything else, forget about it. You know, I'm just a mess. You know, and I have to hire people to kind of manage the messy parts of me, right? The dysfunctional parts of my brain damage, you know. So, and I'm okay with that, you know. But, you know, we're dealing with the addiction. When we're talking about, you're talking about the, what were you just talking about right before this? Because I lose track sometimes.
I'm sorry, I forgot too. I was trying to. No, COVID, the lockdowns, how everything.
It was about women. It was about
going to school in person.
What's that?
Going to school in real person instead of having virtual classes.
Yes, I remember. Okay. Well, let's go outside the box a little bit and talk about that, because that's important. And yeah, I think here's where we've got to kind of, this is where the trauma of COVID has kind of gotten to us to a place where we don't know how to respond to it. Like, nothing has prepared us for it. It's like getting handed a calculus problem and you never learned the fifth grade level fractions, decimals, integers, and algebraic reasoning, and you're trying to solve this calculus problem, right? And you're gonna feel powerless and helpless trying to solve the calculus problem for a while until you learn some of the skills, the new stuff, the new, like, how do we adapt with this? How do we cope with this? How do we develop resiliency around this? Right. Instead of, like, because that's part of building the scaffolding and resources around people so they can not just, you know, get out from the 21 feet deep that they're in, but to begin to swim, you know, and so finding some of those resources. However, so as a neuroscience background, neuropsychology and about the brain science, what you're saying is true. You know, what you learn experientially growing up served you to this point, right? Now we're in a position where all those skills and everything that we learned don't serve us well, right? And so what we have to do is really renew or reinvent and restructure kind of our brain. Like, they were doing some research with these kids, right? Was playing video games dangerous to the brain, right? How did it affect the brain, the plasticity and the symptoms? And so a lot of these parents were saying, well, they're lazy. And the myth of being lazy, right? And the truth was they weren't lazy. A lot of these kids that were playing video games, their brains were able to, like, fire like 100 times faster and learn and keep up with the current economy and workforce and technology. And they were able to advance where a lot of people, the kids that were forbidden from playing video games, were not able to advance and get good jobs because their brains, the neuroscience and the evolution of that. So we got to be careful, you know, because like you said, there's a blessing and a curse, and there's, you know, light and shadows and darkness in every aspect of it. And one of the things around education is we got to find innovative ways to retool for the modern day relationship and education. And I don't know what that looks like. I am not an educator. I just know what the brain's doing and the body and what the, you know, what's going on that way. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, experientially. And I think that the psychopath bankers want to put everyone in front of the same propaganda machine on the teletubes, but we have to learn in real life. We have to learn experientially. We have to learn. Because, like, when you have a teacher that subconsciously doesn't like you, and you both know it, how is that different than having a boss? And, like, how is that different than working on a group project? How is that different than building a bridge? There's always going to be someone on every job site who doesn't like you, or who likes you too much, or shows favoritism to this person.
Well, yes and no, sir. I mean, because one, each job has a certain set of traits or characteristics that are required for the position, whether it's being a job where you're inspiring and developing the human soul and spirit through education, right? That takes a certain type of character to be able to be and teach a child to do that. You're not going to put that, say, it's kind of like being in the right plane and in the right seat, because a lot of times people are in the right plane, wrong seat. You know, so if you have a teacher who is a better at being a drill sergeant, should probably be in the military, right, than a teacher. So it's like, you know, we can't blame the child, because the child is there to absorb and learn. And they have all their stress, you know, the trauma is walking around the classroom, right? And, you know, the teacher's saying, hey, focus on the board, but there's a bear in the room, and the bear is a teacher, you know, and the little kid's supposed to learn how to learn when they're like 5, 10 to solve these calculus problems. So, you know, when you're looking at it through this lens, it makes sense why people have a hard time recovering from addiction and from, you know, from attachment fear, from abandonment fear, because we can't, you know, get beyond some of these, you know, because I want to help people recognize, and when you're dealing with trauma and attachment stuff and learning disabilities, there are a lot of these things are really clustered together, right? And, you know, it's multidimensional. So we're kind of looking at, because the job and the role of, say, a someone that's on the construction crew, you know, you're going to have certain different qualities and traits that you have to face and deal with. But you don't put a child in that position, right? Or someone that's not qualified to be standing on a iron beam 100 feet above the ground and told to rivet something that they don't have the skill to do. So, yeah, I mean, that's where, you know, I hear you. It's like that's very frustrating to be able to people get there, you know. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, and I think it's probably not a good idea for the government to mass traumatize as much people as often as possible. I think that's probably pretty lame.
Oh my gosh. Re-traumatization over and over and over again.
But even the government has to traumatically reenact.
You said something about restitution before, like some sort of like acknowledgement, right? Validation of the past and some acknowledgement. I agree, man.
Yeah.
Because that is like, because, you know, one of our greatest psychic woundings is in humanity, it's denial. It's denial of that reality. It's denial of that experience. It's denial of that, that it ever happened, or minimization, right? Or, you know, denial is very powerful because it just keeps the shame going, the story, right? Around shame. Because it's kind of like your nervous system never closes the loop, kind of stays in this negative feedback loop, and that trauma never closes because there's no recognition or validation to close, because that's the antidote. And they're withholding the only antidote that's possible.
Yeah, right. And we're the children of the government. And right now it's like, well, daddy lied us into Vietnam and he's abused, but he still loves me, you know? The citizens of America have been abused.
The daddy is, yeah, well, you have daddy and mommy. Well, that's a dysfunctional family, right? The daddy-mommy issues.
So are we talking about the Clintons?
You know, that's the politics of Republican daddies and Democratic mommies, you know, the mommy dearests and the, you know, the drill sergeant dad and the helicopter mom, you know, that whole family dynamic again. So I don't know how to look at politics that way other than this family, dysfunctional family we got, you know, and you got two abusive parents, you know, and they don't know how to take care of their children, kind of base jumping off of your world, being children of the government. So, you know, being children of the government, there's, you know, that one down position to the government, you know, I don't want to be in that position myself, but that's where we are, you know.
Well, I met you 2013, a little puppy dog looking for love at a speed dating event, you know what I mean? And I see the same beautiful guy in front of me, Dr. Joe Wickham. What a pleasure this has been. What a great conversation. Thank you, brother.
Well, you know, it's really good to connect with you and talk about these issues from 30,000 feet.
How can people find you?
What's that?
How can people find you? What's your website?
They can go to www.relationshipsociety.com. Mm-hmm. Joe@relationshipsociety.com. Or 310-560-0726. That's my Santa Monica number. So hopefully you'll be able to find Joe. I'll be kind of traveling the world the next 5 years and building up my base camp, and I'll be doing maybe some of these shows from Kiev, Ukraine next time, or Odessa next time we talk.
Yeah, this has been episode 313 of Highway Diaries. I got some plugs. You can go to erichollerbach.com, ericholerbach.com. I got stand-up specials there. You can go look at Klaus Schwab Jr., the shenanigans that he's getting into. I'm going to be in Las Vegas. I'm not going to be. Klaus Schwab Jr. is going to do a show in Las Vegas October 16th with Sam Tripoli and Eddie Bravo. He's going to be announcing the banking takeover of the world. We have a sponsor for this program. If you go to acbdremedy.com, that's acbdremedy.com, type in promo code Eric, E-R-I-C, you get 20% off your order. So you can get some cannabis oil. It's a family company. Thank you so much to my guest, Joe Wickham, Dr. Joe Wickham. He's going to be traveling around the world, fixing everybody's trauma like Johnny Appleseed around the world.
There's a funny story about that, too. All right, yes. Good plug. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Take care, buddy.
All right. Thank you. Good luck.
There you have it. Dr. Joe Wickham. This has been episode Highway Diary 313. Bye, everybody.